Unity is strength. We got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY.
Come. Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Now, right now.
Now the time to do the right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now. Right now.
Let's do it right now. We don't need to fuss and fight.
We've got to have peace.
That's right. That's right. We are going to do it right. This is Jamala Rogers, her host of Voices from the Battlefield. And there is a number of things going on, and there are so many battlefields. People are fighting for democracy. They're fighting for economic justice, for political power, healthcare, education, police accountability. It's all there. And we have folks across this nation that are fighting. And this show helps to lift up those battles, but also to connect the battles, because sometimes we feel very isolated in our little, you know, municipalities, our little cities, our little neighborhoods. But believe me, wherever there is repression and oppression, there is resistance. So this is Black August Month, where we recognize the struggles and sacrifice of African in this country and around the world. And it's also Black Pride Month, and so right now we don't have any activities going on, but we will get those, because I know something is supposed to happen next weekend. And most importantly, I want to give a status report on Christopher Dunn. You know, last week, he was exonerated after a lot of, you know, back and forth from the state AG, who, you know, coincidentally won his reelection. But Christopher Dunn is well. Him and his wife left last week, driving to California. He'll be there for a minute trying to readjust. And, you know, here's the thing about when I tell people he couldn't fly. Folks, well, why not? Well, you've been in prison 34 years. You do not have a damn ID, okay? So, I mean, things that we just take for granted. They had to drive across the country because Chris does not have an official ID. So obviously they're going to get all that connected. He's got a lot to do, and we wish him well. Sometime in the future, once they get settled, we'll definitely have Kira and Chris on the show. We had Kira on here last year talking about the case, so she's not new to Voices from the Battlefield. So I'm going to introduce my guest today. There were going to be three J's, and now it's going to be four J's, and now there's three J's. Janice Mensa was going to be one of the guests, because he was a facilitator at the Pomoja session where some of these findings came out. But you will recall we had Janice on the show last year as she was assaulted by the guards at the CJC. And it's coming up on a year for that, and she is feeling some kind of way, or he's feeling some kind of way about that, and we understand that. And also, you know that there was some issues with the CJC just a couple of days ago. And so when you hear about all of this stuff that's going on, there is a certain trigger. So we understand Janice's situation, and we wish him well, particularly around the mental health piece. But I know that they will continue to be in the struggle. So who we do have here is Jonathan Pulfus and Johnson Lancaster. And of the two, Jonathan is new to Voices from the Battlefield. This is his first time on. And these are folks that we know and trust in the community. They've been doing the work. Johnson was here. He can talk about so many stuff. But I think the last time you were here, Johnson, we were talking about the Black Catholics and their little new plan, which apparently is moving pretty aggressively now, because there's some more consolidations of black parishes. So we'll have to talk about that again. But welcome, Johnson Lancaster. And Jonathan Pulfus was one of the activists at the Ferguson epicenter, and so he's got different insights. So these are people who help facilitate the discussion around what do we learn from Ferguson, what do we need to do, and what do we need to be looking at in the future. So again, welcome, Johnson and Jonathan.
Thank you for having me, Mom.
Glad to be here.
Okay, so you know, we would be terribly irresponsible if we didn't do something around the election results last night, particularly Cori Bush's defeat to Wesley Bell. So, I mean, we're going to have to do a deeper dive later on, but what is you all's initial thinking about the what and the why and what's going to happen now? Either one of you can go.
Go ahead, Brother Johnson.
Well, I'll go ahead and start. I think we learned quite a lesson on the power of super PAC money in the result of a race. Understanding that this was the second most expensive congressional race ever. The first one, I think, was with Jamal Bowman. It was $18 million that was spent against him to get him out in New York. And $12 million spent against Cori Bush to get the results that they had. And even with the inequality in terms of the resources to run a campaign, this campaign, the Cori Bush campaign, lost only about a 4% margin. Mm-hmm. It says something about the strength of that candidacy and the work that had been put into the campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
But as somebody said, you know, this isn't horseshoes or hand grenades, it's politics.
Right.
So we have to go ahead and accept that this is a temporary defeat, a temporary loss.
What do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, so I think that I agree with what Brother Johnson said. We got 2 years, so, you know, Cori was real close, and without a question, if she wanted to reignite that campaign, she really could. I think what struck out to me were some of the wolf and sheep clothing here locally, the interesting endorsements from purportedly progressive circles that are more moderate circles or individuals, quote-unquote leaders in the community, that voted against the people's interests and publicly endorsed a candidate who has done nothing but lied and sought personal gain from politics. And so I think that that's been very interesting. But I want to salute all the organizers and all the workers and all the people on the front lines that fought on Cori's behalf, and salute Cori for her candidacy. As Brother Johnson said, it was real close, and she got a real close chance of getting things going, so that's that. Yeah.
So one of the things that I always talk about is voter turnout, and in St. Louis, it seems particularly low, and I would say for Northside wards, even lower. In the last aldermanic election in the 22nd, now 13th ward, it was like 9%. You know, I think that's pathetic. And if you were all the person of that ward, and previously it was Jeffrey Board and now it's Pam Board, you know, to me that would be almost the number one priority. How do I get my people engaged? And it's not just engaged around my agenda. It's like engaged around their agenda. What do you want me to be doing? But it seems like to me, and I've written about this over the years, there's a certain amount of voter suppression that goes on even with the black elected officials who fear any kind of opposition. And so they think that if they get people riled up or engaged, then they might rile up against them. Well, yeah, if you're not doing what you're supposed to, that might happen. But the fact that it was so low, I think that 7,000, we probably could have done it if we had done some additional real work around the people in the margins. Because the folks who are politically engaged, they knew what was happening, and they came out, they, you know, gave money, whatever. And Johnson, you and I both were at the watch party. It was a pretty diverse group of folks who've been working on this campaign. I don't know that I've seen that in a while. I mean, really diverse. Some of the most progressive elements of our movement were in that room. And so I think for me, that was inspiring, but I think to see the margin in which Cori Bush lost was to me amazing, because this man had more dollars to spend. Somebody told me this morning that they received 40 pieces of mail from that campaign. Now, you know, that's just like, you got so much money to spend, you don't even know what to do with it. So I don't think we are surprised about the loss. We hope that it would have been a different outcome. So then we could say, hey, money isn't everything. Because I've seen candidates be able to transcend the amount of money coming in, but it was a ground game that was pretty pretty aggressive and pretty penetrating, and so that's, I think, was the real missing piece here, that some of those communities that we knew could have made a difference, there was not a whole lot of activity there. And I also, I think we need to look at in the future the role of social media, because I think it's overrated. And one thing you know about working in politics, particularly if you ran a campaign, or it's about voter contact. Every voter is not going to be reached by social media. So you have to have a multi-pronged strategy about how you're going to reach voters, how you're going to get them out. And yeah, and so I think we need to do a little bit more research and investigation about what strategies could work there going forward, because we got an election coming up in November, we got some coming up next spring, and so whatever we're learning from this campaign, we ought to be able to apply it in the future. So hats off to Cori Bush for running a phenomenal campaign and being, to me, outstanding elected official, a public servant, and for that, I think she has no apologies for. I know people were saying she should have done this, or maybe she should have been so vocal on Palestine. But that's what we sent her there for. I mean, to watch out for our money, because that's our money, y'all. The billions that goes to Israel, those are our tax dollars. There is a genocide being funded in our name. So yes, she was standing up for that. So I don't think this is the end. And she pretty much said that in her speech. I'm not quite sure what that means with her next steps, but I think there would be a number of people that would be standing right there with her. Johnson, did you want to say anything else about that?
Well, the ground game, the door-to-door canvassing, I think that helped to make up the gap. The polls are showing that the Rusty Bell is going to win by 6%. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the gap that could have been overcome. I noticed that Maria Supreme Ball and Ron Hershaw together, they got about 4% of the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually the amount that it separated Cori Bush and Rusty Bell from being in a dead heat in either.
Right, right.
So this does cause us to focus on turnout.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Rusty Bell had decent turnout in the suburbs.
Right.
And he peeled off some votes in the city. And I was thinking about when Cori Bush ran against Lacey Clay. Lacey Clay beat her in the suburbs. okay?
Mm-hmm.
But she, but the vote that she got in the city helped put her over the top.
Right. Right.
Okay? So she was able to make up for the difference. And that's how she beat Lacey Clay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And with $2 million.
Right.
Yeah.
She made $2 million this time, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that turnout is key. We really have to figure out a way to boost.
Right.
To boost the numbers. Okay? Because we've got 170,000 registered voters in the city of St. Louis. Out of a population of close to 170,000 registered voters, there's no way we should be having a turnout of something like, 29,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
We should be getting a lot more people to come to the polls.
Right. Yeah.
If you look at it from a demographic perspective, the city is about 50%, a little bit over 50% black. It's a majority black city.
Mm-hmm.
It's just fair, but it's 51 to 53% black. Okay, so that's about 85,000 black voters. Okay, we're only getting total 27,000 people voting.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's criminal. That is criminal. Criminal. Criminal.
No.
So I think, going forward, I agree with that 100%, and we have to figure out some creative ways of doing that other than social media. I know folks spend a lot of money with those ads on social media, but there are a number of folks, and not just seniors, that are not on social media. And so how do we get to them? How do we convince them? Because some of this really requires face-to-face conversations. Because I can tell you, the people who had questions or who had misinformation, once you talk to them, they're like, oh, okay, I didn't know that. But, you can't get to everybody. You can get to some people. And so I think the ground game is going to be crucial in the future. Yeah. Okay, good people, let's talk about what we found out. So I'm just going to give people some context, and first by saying the opinions expressed on Black Radio Hall of Fame are those of the program host and not necessarily the opinions of Harris Stowe State University, RBRFH. And I would probably say in this case, they may not even be the opinions of the program host. What we have done is collected findings from a community forum that was hosted by the Organization for Black Struggle a couple of weeks ago, and it was to really look at what have we learned from the Ferguson Uprising, what did we gain, what did we lose, what is still to be done. And so the folks who were there had, some opinions, as we all do, about that. And so this is what we're presenting today. So Johnson and Jonathan and Janice were all facilitators of small group discussions. And so the findings have been compiled, and we're going to start with the question that we asked. The first question was, name five positive, tangible improvements that you think came out of the Ferguson Uprising. And when we say tangible, we meant like you could see it, feel it, touch it, a policy change, a personnel change, an elected official change. And so let's just start with that. What was some of the high consensus issues that people saw as improvements, either Jonathan or Johnson, either one?
Yeah, so one of the first things out the gate that was shared, or there was a theme sitting in that space, was concerns around criminal justice. And so true, and we'll get to setbacks in a minute, but, McCulloch being removed from office, which is probably something a lot of people, can really feel, was definitely a win. Even if the person that replaced McCulloch didn't necessarily, according to Freedom Community Center's reporting about the jail population and how he treats misdemeanor, low-level nonviolent offenses and things like that, even though Wesley Bell isn't the candidate that he promised to be, I think McCulloch stepping down was definitely a major win. And then I'll just name a second one and then pass it to Brother Johnson. I think that the push for the closure of the workhouse by organizations locally, grassroots organizations locally, OBS, Action St. Louis, et cetera. That whole campaign, RC Defenders, that push was definitely also a major win because we're talking about restroom of mass incarceration and the workhouse's complicity in lifting and continuing and furthering that. So I'll go ahead and pass it to you, Brother Johnson.
Johnson?
We also had the Ferguson Police Department ended up with a series of black police chiefs.
Yep.
One
almost every year, right?
Right. Right. So then we also had municipal court reform, a push to an end in cash bail. And these municipalities that have been picking the pockets of lots of drivers and people of color.
Mm-hmm.
Got a limit placed on how much the municipal revenue could be derived from those kangaroo court type of situations.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course you got more black political representation.
Right.
Wesley Bell ended up on the Ferguson City Council. And then later on, Ella Jones became the mayor, the first black, I think she was the first female mayor of Ferguson. We got Tim Gardner as a prosecutor. And several state and local representatives across the region.
Mm-hmm.
That's a direct result.
Yeah. Well, we got two young folks who were actually on the streets there, you know, Rasheem Aldridge and Alicia Saunier, Rasheem went on to be a state rep and then came back to the city, and Alicia's there as the 7th Ward. So, but we did.
Rasheem was also on the Ferguson Commission.
That's right. And so there was, we talked about like the fact that these people got elected, all of them were not effective in their job, which meant that we ended up talking about them and what did we lose or what did happen, right? So I don't know how people feel about Mayor Ella Jones. I've heard different things from different people. But I think the important thing is like if people follow the agenda that they were given, like here's our concerns and this is why we want you to be there. It seems like if they hold to that, then they'll do all right. But when they get in there and they start trying to do their own thing or they get influenced by money or other political powers that are in opposition to their constituency, I think that's when they run into some serious problems. And that's the case with Wesley Bell. Because clearly he became prosecutor on the backs of the movement around Ferguson Uprising. You know, we talked about the prosecutors. You know, we did get rid of McCullough. We got Wesley. We also got Kim Gardner in the city. But, you know, the pressure on her, even after 2 years of being elected, we don't have her there anymore. And so it seems to me there's something to be said about when we get people put in office that we really, really want there, that we don't have the necessary muscle to keep them there or protect that office. Do you all agree with that?
Yeah, I think part of the issue is what we talked about earlier with this recent campaign outcome between Corey and Wesley. It's about staying power, voter engagement, political education. You have to engage the neighborhoods and you got to engage, and like you said earlier about all the persons, like engage in their own wards and things like that, having regular meetings, keeping people connected. People have to understand just the power of their voice and their vote. And I think some people get disillusioned because, you know, they get elected officials like Wesley, who said he was going to do something A, and then he ends up doing B or Z or D.
Or nothing.
Or doing nothing at all. And being, you know, a snake with everything. So I think the main thing is that, you know, people need to see people for who they are, learn lessons from what's happened in the past, and let that inform just decision making when it comes to moving forward. I saw Action St. Louis, Kayla had advertised, they knocked on 50,000 doors. And made 200,000 phone calls, and that's commendable, that's exceptional. But I think the onus isn't just on groups like OBS or Action or these different entities. It needs to be just a culture within our community where we do that all the time. Mm. And it's not only when there's a, you know, it's time for an election. Mm.
And I think that's the thing that people get a little bit disgusted about. Wait a minute, I haven't seen you in 4 years, or I haven't seen you in 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they really have issues in between them that you haven't even heard or don't want to hear. So they definitely have a view about these elected officials. Mm-hmm. I'm looking at the whole reform prosecutor field. And when Kim Gardner became prosecutor, across the country there were a number of prosecutors, and we did not know there were so many of them until they came to St. Louis to support Kim, and they stood out there on those courtroom steps. And there were a number of them, particularly black ones. You know, we need to take a look at how many of them are still there, because like Kim, a number of them have been kicked out. Mosley over there in Baltimore, she you know, got kicked out. So this is the thing, y'all. When we put people in, that's not where our job ends. It's like putting them in. Our job is to see how we're going to do two things. Hold them accountable and protect the office. Protect the agenda that we put them there for. So it'd be interesting to see what that group looks like now in 2024. But there was, and I thought you were going to mention this, Jonathan, the prosecutor's report. A number of organizations have been at the prosecutor's table, and we issued a report. We need to get somebody from that group to come on and talk about that, because there's some lessons to be learned from that as well. That prosecutor piece is so important for our folks who are victims of mass incarceration, victims of police, you know, misconduct and corruption, that as to how they end up there in the first place. So we got to spend some time there. What about some of the?
So,
go ahead.
I just want to add to that. When Kim Gardner was first elected, and she set out to reform the Circuit Attorney's Office and not be the kind of prosecutor that was going to be so quick to put people under the jail, because not everybody who comes in contact with the criminal justice system needs to go to jail. Okay? That's why she created a diversion program. And it became quite evident that the legal establishment in the city was alarmed and decided that they were going to work to remove her. So we were able to beat that back, because we were able to re-elect her to the position. Okay? And then when she actually challenged the governor. People don't understand that the governor wasn't just looking at two lawsuits from the St. Louis Circuit Attorney. The Cole County prosecutor was filing charges against him, and his own General Assembly was trying to impeach him. We're talking about Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
So Brighton had four different investigations. Okay, they're going on at the same time. But he chose to attack Kim Gardner after he was done. We chose to come after the black prosecutor in St. Louis. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
And Dave Gore was part of that group from the legal establishment that was in league with the people that were trying to oust Kim Gardner. And I don't think people remember that.
Well, don't, because unless you've been involved with it, you won't, because there's so much other stuff happening you can barely keep up with the madness. I mean, most of black folks are in survival mode, and that's by design too. Just keep them busy, you know, trying to survive, and they never will be able to find time for their own liberation. So this is true. But I think that's why these kind of conversations are important, because those of us who have some insight, and some of us have it from different angles, that's why it's important to bring the collective together, is that you see these issues happening, and when you pull back the curtain, you see another layer of things happening that you wouldn't normally see. You're just reading the newspaper, or you're just looking at a TV coverage on it. You know, you really have to delve deep and see what is going on, because Johnson, to your point, this is the same strategy that they're using against the squad. Mm-hmm. The first two people were the black Congress people. And they're going to move on to the other ones, to AOC and you know, the two black ones, they felt like with low-hanging fruit, and let's get them on out the way and build some momentum. So, again, and me and Jonathan were talking about this before we went on air, the thing that really pisses me off and makes me angry is we act like this stuff is all new. This stuff has been going on. They got the same divide and conquer tactics they've been using, and we seem to fall forward every single time. So my thing is, like, we need to get more savvy. Our movement needs to get more savvy. Our voters need to get more savvy and more informed. And, you know, we got to see some breakthroughs going forward. Elsewise, the MAGA folks will put a grip on this democracy like we've never seen before. So, you know, the thing I think is so interesting about Ferguson uprising, and we know that it came from the absolute brutal murder of Mike Brown Jr., who laid in that street for hours, which was another thing that I think just incited people. The fact that there was that murder, the fact that there were the kind of mobilization and outrage that happened as a result of that, that reverberates across the country. It's why you had the reaction to a George Floyd. You couldn't have had that reaction without a Ferguson uprising. So sometimes it may not be as measurable as we think, but once you start to look at, as I said, connecting the dots to see what caused this to happen, what was a factor in that happening, you then have to begin to look at what is the energy behind some of these movements, some of these actions, and how important it is for us here in the St. Louis region to really be the first to double down and figure out what happened and what we got, so that other people can start to do the same thing wherever they are. There were some other issues, I think, under that. I think one of the things came up was the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. And I would also put on there the attack on DEI, that's diversion, equity, and inclusion. So those things came from the highest, you know, courts of the land, and really, I think, pretty much floored people in terms of how do you move forward with voting rights and with DEI, because a lot of the programs now are being gutted on the university level and sometimes even in the corporate side. I mean, people are fearful now of the Zionists coming after them or threatening to withhold money. Particularly, this has happened to state universities and colleges. Like, you say, okay, if you want this money for that new building, you know, this happened in Wisconsin. If you want this, you got to pull back on that DEI stuff. And so initially they stood the ground, and then they just buckled under. So now there's, you know, they dismantled all the DEI, and now they got a new building. So, you know, it's like this is the world that we live in, but we have some control over what happens. We just not exercising our full power because we don't think we have it. We think the other folks have it. I'm going to move us to the five improvements that we think we saw. The setbacks. Five setbacks that you think were a result of the Ferguson uprising.
Yeah, so, I think you kicked it off with two of them, right? Two matches, one around DEI. And then again, this reaction that we forced with the Zionist movement attacking sincere progressive candidates and institutions that are trying to do right. I'd be remiss if I didn't lift up just the brutalization, the retaliation, and backlash that happened just on the literal grounds in the streets of West Florida and around St. Louis and in Ferguson, right? So I'm thinking about Darren Seals. His mysterious death, Right. Found burnt up in the car. I know there's a podcast. We were shipping it down, and some other people got the podcast, and we're still trying to investigate his death. But there were other brothers that were found burnt up in cars on West 4th and around, in and around the protest. I'm thinking about Bison Massey, he mysteriously overdosed. Ever Crawford mysteriously committed suicide, right? All these allegations, all these alleged incidents that have happened. Joshua Williams still locked up for a nonviolent offense that cost him 8+ years of his life, and he was a teenager when all this stuff happened. And so for me, I think the main thing is, you know, in response to that, how does the movement come together to look out for each other, care for each other, show support for one another as we are doing this work? Because there are forces that would rather see us found burnt up in the core, mm-hmm. or would want to drive you just the physical, mental, emotional, spiritual cost of being involved in this work. How do you sustain yourself in that process? So I want to lift that up. And the last thing I want to lift up for our pastor, Brother Johnson, is again, this conversation about bail. I can't talk about bail enough. His refusal to open the case. The main reason, and a setback is, the main reason why he was put in office, why he had that on the ground support for his initial run for prosecuting attorney, which is what put him on the radar to become a congressperson now that he is, was because he promised the Michael Brown family he would reopen the case and do everything within his power to make that happen. And he did the exact opposite. He got comfortable, he got in that position, and he basically said, well, color was right, y'all were wrong. And so, you know, that's another setback. So, yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and pass it to you, Brother Johnson.
Johnson.
Well, we have the failure of national police reform in Congress.
Absolutely.
Even though we had a special presidential commission to look at police reform, and we had bills introduced in Congress to pursue national registry of police who have been responsible for misconduct. We weren't allowed to get that passed. We had a surge in the Police Bill of Rights legislation. The police lobby was able to get these laws passed that so-called give them greater protection and immunity from their misconduct. We had a bill passing a rule that requires the city to defend police officers if they are sued in civil cases and to reimburse the officers if they lose income during investigation. So, I think something you said earlier, you said, as we fight against repression, the system becomes more repressive. Whenever you resist and attempt to make gains, the system gets more oppressive. And then you have to fight even harder.
Right.
So that's the environment we find ourselves in. The far right is moving further right, and we have an increase in surveillance. And the police state.
Right.
And that's all because we were making gains in dismantling the police state.
And Johnson, this is, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but this is what I'm talking about when I say studying history and things that repeat themselves. Every time there is a aggressive gain by black folks, there is a white lash. So when people say right. This is the third Reconstruction, then we ought to say, well, what was one and two? Every time we do this, there is going to be that. So why are we not surprised when it happens, and why are we not prepared when it happens to resist it or at least neutralize it? Because when, remember after Ferguson, they started this whole thing about Blue Lives Matter.
Yeah,
they started the thing about, you know, we own the streets. I mean, they got visibly, like, in your face with the stuff. And then, because they have a powerful lobby, they went down to Jeff City and got those laws passed that you just talked about. Why are we not going the other direction? What some of us have been saying is when a police kills somebody, they are to be criminally charged and criminally responsible. But instead, what happens is there's a civil suit by a family, but who gets paid? That's the city that pays that because of the insurance. I'm saying, and other folks have echoed this, is when police have to come out of their pocket for their misbehavior, their misconduct, we probably see a different kind of officer out there on the streets. But right now, there is nothing to hold them accountable. They get a smack on the hand. If there's a lawsuit, you know, the taxpayers pay that. So where is the change going to come from? So I think this whole notion of these folks are highly organized, well-resourced, and whatever we come up with in terms of policing, we just have to be ready to respond and to protect whatever we're saying, because they're going to be there throwing their barbs even around. If you recall, when we introduced the new legislation around the civilian oversight, all of a sudden there's a lawsuit that held it up for a whole year. And guess who joined it? The Ethical Society, which is the Black police officers. What? So, I mean, so there's this brotherhood against the hood. That's the way I look at it. The police brotherhood against the hood. And we still are not organized, not only to react to it or to organize it. Sometimes we don't even see it. We don't even know that's what happened.
Yes.
So if you're just joining us, we are here with Jonathan Pulfus and Johnson. There's too many Johns in here. Johnson Lancaster. And we are talking about some of the findings that came out of Ferguson uprising, lessons learned. What do we know? What are we going to do? And we are going through the five setbacks that were a result of the Ferguson uprising. And, you know, think about, for example, and I remember saying this in the group that I was in, sometimes there is an attitude that you can't normally see, but people are feeling like, I ain't going through this again. Like, I'm not letting these folks pull this mess over me again. A veil has been taken off a lot of the folks after Ferguson. Because one, it revealed that you got an apartheid situation in Ferguson. A predominantly Black municipality with all white, you know, council, all white police force, might as well have been an all white police force. So when people saw that happen, it's like, where have we been? Why didn't we know that? And so I'm saying that, you know, we got to be woke and informed and on the case. And it doesn't mean that you're on the case about everything, because hopefully you can pick one thing that you can zero in on and let somebody else pick another thing. And so that we got a number of ears and eyes watching this stuff. But these folks are moving in ways that we don't necessarily know because they already organized. And I'm saying that every time something comes up around policing, they kick in down at the legislature and they, you know, put their lobbyists on and next thing you know, it's been gutted or it's, you know, stalled or whatever. And so I think we just have to be more organized because we don't have a lobbyist for us. You know, our lobbyists gonna come with the power of the people. So, I'm just saying that because I think that when I see people even on the street, they just not taking this stuff anymore. And you see it even in labor. I mean, after Ferguson, we saw more upsurge with workers' struggles, workers' rights, people, you know, trying to unionize and being very successful at it, you know, including, folks that we didn't even think would ever get organized, like, you know, the coffee people at Starbucks and you know, folks at Amazon. So people were in motion. And I always like to think about that energy came from Ferguson where people said, we ain't taking this no more. You know, y'all paying us pennies and pesos, making all this money. Why should we? So that attitude about, I'm not taking this no more. I'm fired up. I ain't taking this no more. I saw in many different ways as some of these struggles start to emerge or even got more aggressive. So let's name five improvements that the region needed, but we didn't get. What happened that we said we need an end to this, but it didn't happen?
I would say right off the bat, echoing that police accountability aspect too. It's not just on Westie because this happens in the city too. These police killings happen. There's no, sometimes no, even no charges at all. If there are charges, they get found not guilty. You think about Anthony Lamar Smith with Jason Stockley, Vondae Myers, Jason Flannery, Mike Brown, Darren Wilson. And these police get to just live their life. And, you know, legally you can't really say, oh, with murder, because they haven't been convicted, but we all know what it is at the end of the day. And, you know, I think that that's something that the region needed for sure that we didn't get. I would say also in the area of education, so there are students, you know, at Mizzou's campus concern 19-01950, who got the removal of their president, Tim Wolf, and then at St. Louis U, you know, students are demonstrating, to get the Clark Tower Accords. But I would say, like, the teeth haven't, because the purpose of these agreements with these institutions or these negotiations was to increase the quality of the black experience on these campuses. And in response to what happened to Mike Brown, he had just graduated from Normandy, and questions were being asked, like, why can't Mike attend an institution like this? You know, why can't people, young brothers and sisters that look like him, be able to attend these institutions? And now what you see, speaking on that backlash again, is that they're starting to rearrange these DEI departments happening within Mizzou and all that stuff. It's an Asian American president at Mizzou who, because of pressure from alums and from pressure from community and from funders, had to gut pretty much their DEI program and, like, separate it out into different departments and stuff. So I would say one thing the change the region needed in terms of improvement again, is these universities having a level of backbone, you know. And Pastello's, you know, he's stepping down, but I'm scared to see who's going to be next, but, you know, I commend him for what he did in 2014 in terms of signing the Clark Tower Accords, but, you know, we need, you know, real concrete, tangible things coming out of it in the area of education, because, you know, as Malcolm X said, that's the passport to the future, and some of the young people don't. They just haven't had that engagement. So, Right. Yeah, those two things.
Well, Ken, you know, this came up when we were, there was a discussion about DEI, and the sister at Lincoln U committed suicide and found out that it was, you know, based on, you know, harassment from the president. But what people didn't know was that the president was white. And when they found out, it's like, wait a minute, how did a historically black college get a white president? So what's up with that, Johnson? I'm asking you because you keep up with this stuff. You're from a historically black college. What's up?
Unfortunately, you know, Lincoln University does have a Board of Regents. Okay? And I'm sure they had a search committee that began to look for, you know, a new college president. And unfortunately, we find ourselves with sometimes a certain mindset that, you know, we want to be more egalitarian, and more equitable than the people that are running the dominant society. And so we have these missteps where historically black colleges will go ahead and hire a white president. Okay? Thinking that he's going to do right by us as a people. And there's no real historical or cultural connection with the institution. And the mission of the institution. You know, that really shouldn't have happened at all.
You tell me that there are no
seasoned and professional, experienced black school administrators that could have taken the job, that they could have found the point to that position.
I think people were really taken off by that, and then the fact that whatever his behavior was that caused that sister to commit suicide, surely there were some glimpses of that before that happened and before he even came to that university. So what was it about him that he was the right person for that job? I mean, this again is like, we're not in those circles, I know. And we're not on the trustees, we're not on a committee, but it seems to me that if you went to that college, you would want some say-so about hearing that something like that happened. I mean, what my main point with this is, like, we give up our power when we really should be holding on to it and using it instead of, like, saying, okay, let them do it. They know best. No. This man has made a mess out of people's lives. Yeah.
We do not live in a post-racial society.
No. Surprise, surprise. Surprise, surprise.
You know, we just can't, okay, think the difference and you can go ahead and hire a white president for a black college. No, you can't.
Mm-mm. No.
You just can't. So some of the other things that we were looking for that we haven't gotten yet, like the end to the militarization of the police.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We haven't gotten that yet.
No.
Okay.
In fact, it's gotten more militarized.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Got more militarized, especially with the technology for the surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a police misconduct registry, so we can track these guys when they go from one department to another, and we don't wind up with the problem we had in Sangamon County. Yeah, a guy who certainly should have been a police officer ends up going to somebody's house and call for help. And shooting him in the face three times. This guy had red flags all over the place, but he was allowed to skip from one department to another.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a sign of gray? You said Springfield, Brother Johnson?
John,
right.
Okay, he said yeah.
Wait, I didn't hear the question. What was the question?
Oh.
No, I was asking if you were referencing, if you said Springfield, if you were referencing Sonya Gray, I didn't know, because it sounded similar, but yeah.
Sonya Massey.
Sonya Massey, I'm sure.
Repeat the question for me, because I'm having a problem with the volume.
No, it's cool, Brother Johnson. I got to clarify. I had misnamed
okay.
What I was referencing, but I got what you're saying about the police misconduct registry. It's definitely needed.
Yeah. So I think, you know, one of the things that we looked at, and I'm going to ask you all this in the few minutes that we have left, the Ford to Ferguson people are obviously doing their own research and interviewing folks about what they think. And one of the interesting questions that they asked me, and I'm going to ask of you, is what would unflinching progress look like in this region going forward? And so one of the things I said was, because the day that they interviewed me was the day that Chris Dunn had been exonerated, but not released. And what I said was unflinching progress would look like when somebody gets exonerated, that the state attorney general is not going to use the power of that office to keep them locked up for no damn apparent reason except that they can do that. That needs to stop and desist. And before that, we need to have a whole system that's more aggressive than these integrity units that are seeking whole sections of people who were mischarged, convicted, and who've been serving long sentences. There's a number of folks still in there like that. So this drip, drip, drip of Chris Dunn here, Lamar Johnson here, that's not going to work in order to transform that system. So, but minimally, when somebody has gone through all the hoops and whatever, and they get exonerated, but you have a state attorney general that says, no, I believe they're still guilty. I don't care what the DNA says. I don't care what I don't care. I'm going to use my power to keep them in jail. That needs to stop. So that was my example. What do you all think unflinching progress would look like in the future for this region?
So, you are bringing to mind something that Governor Westmore did in Maryland, where he issued 177,000.
Oh, yeah.
Maryland, 177,000 marijuana conviction pardons.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Changing the lives of all of those people overnight.
Mm.
Okay? himself to do that, he realized he had the power to do it. He realized that, okay, I don't know how long I'm going to be in this position. I need to go ahead and take care of this now. Okay? So if we could get to a point where we have that type of enlightenment in the system so that we can go ahead and help restore the lives of that number of people all at one time, well, then I would say, okay, this is your problem. So what you're talking about is in terms of all these people that have been railroaded into prison under false pretenses across the state of Missouri. How many people is that, and how long has that been going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would be real progress to me.
Mm-hmm.
If we're able to reach that kind of scale.
Right. What do you think, Jonathan? What would be unflinching progress?
It's hard to name one, but I'm gonna name the most obvious one. Definitely addressing these police killings, officers being held accountable for their misconduct and for their actions. If it wasn't for that bullet from Darren Wilson, you know, a twisted negative benefit that came out of this is this movement, you know, is the rise of Black Lives Matter behind Ferguson, is all these different things. So I think, you know, addressing that, put the police brutality and all those different things, I think that'll go a long way. And I'll just say that I have others, but I know it's just one.
Yeah, that's, but we want other people to think about too. I want the listeners to think about what would unflinching progress look like to you as we celebrate, the 10th anniversary of the Ferguson uprising, but always keeping in mind it was because of the death of a young kid by the name of Mike Brown. So you may not have been at the Pomoja session to get your views in here, but there is a survey that you can go to online and give us your input. It's on my website, JamalaRogers.com, and as you know, that's where you can get all the links from the past programs as well as, you know, articles that have been written. But, yeah, so just click that and answer the questions. Best to your ability, because I think people want to be heard on this. This is something that definitely rocked this region, and is still reverberating, and we want to be able to sum it up in ways that are going to be helpful going forward. So go to the website, JamalaRogers.com. We also, tonight, there is a free speech on trial webinar that's being sponsored by the St. Louis Green Party. That webinar, I think you could probably, I don't know if that's on my website yet, but that's tonight. You probably should go to the Green Party website or their Facebook page for that information. Also tonight, Michelle Martin is in town. She's going to be doing Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation 10 years later. Again, this is what people should be doing. We should be, as many conversations we have, to see if we can get consensus on something going forward. But that's going to be at the Greater St. Mark Church this evening at 7 p.m. So yeah, check that out. Tomorrow, two things are happening. In the morning is the Homer G. Phillips Nurses Alumni is going to be in court because they are challenging the use of the name Homer G. Phillips on that piece of a something over there in the north side that's been created by Paul McKee. So that's going to be at 9 a.m. at the Division III Circuit Court in the county. This is the county courthouse, 105 Central, and that is at 9 a.m. That evening, the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression will be having their monthly meeting, and it is going to introduce people to the new ordinance. So we're going to be explaining the new ordinance, what it means, because we feel like citizens need to know that so that they can help keep folks accountable. We also have a whole new, well, not whole new, mainly new Civilian Oversight Board members, and they have been invited too, so you can meet some of them, but we really want people to understand in a deep and profound way what Ordinance 71749 really means, because what we don't often see happening is the alignment of people who are supposed to be implementing these laws, sometimes they just don't have the information, they don't have the knowledge. And so we are going to do our best to educate the public about that to see if they can assist and help with the keeping, being really supportive of the board, but also keeping them accountable. There are a number of Mike Brown Jr., Ferguson Uprising events coming up. Find them. All you got to do is Google. You might want to go to Facebook calendars and see, but it is a lot going on, as well as should. And this is a situation that we don't want to ever, ever forget. And the only way that we do that is to make sure that we are doing things, we are doing substantive things that's going to make a change as opposed to superficial stuff. And the rhetoric is fine, but you got to have something behind it. And that's what this is all about. So take part in any of these summations that you can. Go to the website again to fill out the survey on 10 years later, what's going on with Ferguson. And thank you to Jonathan Pulfus and Johnson Lancaster for being with me today.
Thank you.
This is Jamala, your host. Oh yeah, we got to do it again. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the battlefield.
Time to do the right thing.
We've got to do it.